Hey everyone, Adam D. from Indefensive Ska here. A little note before we start the show. Los Angeles is dealing with multiple catastrophic fires. A lot of people have lost their homes and are in need. If you're able to help, please do so. There are a lot of great organizations you can donate to, like California Fire Foundation, Pasadena Humane Society, Mutual Aid LA, and there's even a list of people in the music industry that have lost their homes. Links are in the show notes for our Rob Harvilla episode. Thanks. Consequence Podcast Network. Welcome to Indefensive Ska. We aim to push back on the mainstream's negative perception of the music. Ska deserves the respect genres like punk, hip-hop, and hardcore find among their listeners. Our host is renowned music journalist and author of the book Indefensive Ska, Aaron Carnes.
Today's topic is ska and movies. There's several movies that frequently get brought up that have a ska component, like Mighty Mighty Boston's cameo in Clueless or Real Big Fish in Basketball. Today we talk about a lesser-known film that is more ska and was released in the year 2009, Band Slam. The film is about a high school kid named Will Burton. His mother gets a new job and they relocate to Lodi, New Jersey. There, Will learns that a band competition called Band Slam is all anyone cares about. He soon manages a band called I Can't Go On, I'll Go On. How does ska factor in? You'll have to see for yourself. To analyze this film, we bring on director Todd Graff and actor Charlie Saxton. Charlie recently released a horror thriller film that he co-wrote and acted in called Art of a Hit. It was co-written and directed by Galen Connell, the actor that played Will in Band Slam, and Todd Graff even had a cameo in the film. Art of a Hit has a lot of musical references as well, but a bit more in the indie rock realm. And now joining me is my co-host, veteran ska musician Adam Davis, who played in the bands Link 80 and Omnigon.
Okay, so you brought up the Mighty Mighty Bosstones Clueless bit.
Yes.
You also brought up the Real Big Fish in Basketball bit.
Yes.
What about the Say Ferris one?
Oh yeah, 10 Things I Hate About You.
Yeah.
That's the 90s trifecta of ska and movies.
I don't think there's any other ones. Are there?
I don't think there's any other like straight up cameos like that, but there's, you know, there's ska in the movies. There's plenty of that.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. Anytime you want to have a silly montage scene. There you go.
Back in the 80s though, the Untouchables were in a number of movies. They were
Fishbone.
Fishbone were in a number of movies. I'm not sure who else, if who else was in any movies. So, you know, every decade's got a few ska movie things going on. But Band Slam isn't a movie that has a cameo of a ska band. It's got ska threaded throughout the movie in a much more thorough way, which I just is interesting. You didn't really see that even in the 90s so much. And 2009 wasn't even really a time when ska was popular.
When we set up this interview, I had not heard of this movie. Had you?
Had not heard of this movie, no. But I will say this. Charlie is a fan of the podcast. He's a fan of us. He listens. And he messaged me and we kind of discussed this idea. And I like Charlie. And I was like kind of unsure because I didn't know what this movie was. And I looked at a trailer and I thought, well, this is kind of like a teen film in the 2000s. So I asked the Discord, our Discord, and Slop Duck in the Discord, who's a huge fan of, leans definitely in the trad realm, was like, yes, I love this movie. And I was like, really? All right. I that was definitely a big reason why I was like, we got to check this out. I just didn't expect him of all people to be an advocate for this. So,
and it just shows if you want to affect change on this podcast, joining the Patreon is the way to do it. So ska fans love to talk about which movies have ska cameos. Band Slam rarely comes up. Hopefully that changes soon.
Hey, I'm Todd Graff. I'm a screenwriter, director, recovering actor. And I think we're going to be talking about Band Slam today, which I wrote and directed.
Hi, I'm Charlie Saxton. I am an actor and a writer and a ska lover, and I was the bass player in Band Slam named Bug.
Before we dive into Band Slam, Charlie, I want to talk about briefly this new movie that you wrote and starred in.
Yes. Yeah. So the movie is called Art of a Hit. It's actually kind of a pseudo bizarro band slam sequel because I co-wrote it and co-produced it with my creative partner, Galen Draper, who was the star of Band Slam. And the rest of the cast features a lot of people who were also in Band Slam. Ryan Donahue stars in it. Tim Joe is one of the stars of it. And we have Adam Lazis, who was one of the music producers on Band Slam. He was also the music producer on this film. And his wife, Linda Cohen, who's just this hugely successful music supervisor. You've seen her name everywhere. She was also the music supervisor for our film, and she was a supervisor for Band Slam. And she also used to work with the man you see in front of you, Mr. Todd Graff, who provides a nice little voiceover cameo in Art of So really just brought the whole family back together again after almost 15 years, you can say.
I play the asshole.
He plays the manager that the band can never get a hold of on the phone until the very end of the movie when he finally calls them back.
So you play a realistic character.
Indeed. It's in that way, it's a documentary. The really crazy thing is that when I was putting together Band Slam and I had to cast it, because that movie is about a band, I wouldn't cast any actors who couldn't really play. And so it didn't make sense even to have acting auditions until I had musical auditions. So we rented a room at SIR for a day and brought all the actors in and had them start jamming to Walking on the Moon. And what else did you guys play?
I was Walking on the Moon. It was Should I Stay or Should I Go? And then it was I Want You to Want Me. Those were the three songs.
And so I would just keep switching them out. You know, they were all there in the room together. And then it would be, and I didn't know any of them. Charlie, you sit in now playing bass with the other guys. And then I'd switch out the drummer and then switch out the guitarist and switch out. And we just did that all day long until they felt like a band. The ones that felt like a band really felt like a band. Then thank God they could also act. But now years later, they're still... For example, Charlie's character in Band Slam is named Bug, and Galen's character in Band Slam has a nickname that's very important to the plot called Dewey. And Charlie, what is your guys' production company called?
Me and Galen's production company is called Dewey and Bug, baby.
And so this band that was created for this fictional movie really kind of became a band. And Charlie and Tim, the guitarist, recorded a bunch. And then they made a movie about a band with the same people that played the band in the original movie because they were put together as a band.
Todd literally changed the course of my life, to say the least. It's incredible.
I think when you watch a movie or a TV show that's about a band, when the actors are not singing or not playing, it's so obvious and it so takes you out of the film.
I agree. And I'm a musician, so it really kills me if I see, I don't know, I know I'm hearing a G and I know that guitarist is playing a C. You know, it makes me want to scream.
What was really cool was we actually recorded the soundtrack for Band Slam before we shot a single frame of it. We were in a rehearsal studio for like 3 weeks, and then we were in a recording studio for, I want to say, maybe like a week and a half, 2 weeks. And we didn't even do overdub tracking, if I'm right, Todd. We recorded those songs all live in the room, one take. Not obviously not one take, but it was just all of us playing at once. And I'll never forget, like, I've never done anything like that since or have. And it was just such a cool energy and just so much fun.
And you say it was pre-recorded, but that's really not true. A bunch of it was shot live because they were a band. When they play I Want You to Want Me in the movie, they're really playing I Want You More, you know, recorded live. There's a long scene where they put together the band where Galen's character turns them into a ska group. And says, no, you know, cross sticks to the drummer, you know, all that stuff that was recorded live and shot live. And that's, you know, wasn't sweetened or anything. What they're playing is really what's in the movie.
Yeah, there was a trailer hooked up outside of the sound stages that had just like a legitimate recording studio set up. And so Todd would then run in and be like, change this level, fix this, do this. Yeah, that is true. We really were playing those songs in that scene in real time.
Very nice. So can you kind of like, for people who have not seen this movie, can you just real briefly explain the premise of the film?
It's high school, right? And in the movie, it's Lodi, New Jersey, but we shot it in Austin. And in order to be near all the musical resources that we needed for the movie. And so he's like an outcast, misfit kid. He's bullied. And when his mom gets a new job in New Jersey and they move to New Jersey and he is in this new high school, he finds out that there's a Battle of the Bands thing that the high school is hugely invested in and has one band in it that's kind of an ersatz Springsteen, Southside Johnny kind of, you know, band. And they win every year. And but our guy, who has no musical talent whatsoever, but sees himself as a Brian Epstein kind of guy, puts together a band. And he builds it around his obsession with David Bowie. And so the narration in the movie are letters that he writes to David Bowie all through the movie, even though he doesn't know David Bowie and he never gets a response and he never, you know, but he finds a community and he finds a purpose in putting together this band and the girl that he meets and the other girl that he meets. And, you know, it's so anyways, that's the story. They take a pilgrimage to Seavey's. We literally built like to the inch. We rebuilt CB's on a soundstage in Austin.
That wasn't CB's? I'm sorry, that wasn't CB's?
No.
Oh, wow.
What the exterior was. We went to New York to shoot the exterior, but now CB's is a John Varvatos store. And so you couldn't shoot the interior. And so they literally, you know, built it. And I spent, you know, I used to be in a band. I spent a tremendous amount of time at Seavey's. And so I would go in and say, oh, my God, if only the toilet looked like this. Fucking all up. You know, where is this? Where is that? No, that was on the list. So it was really a tremendous amount of time and effort put into getting all the details right for that. And the same with the soundtrack. And, you know, I have a song by Shaq. I don't know if you guys know Shaq. But I mean, they don't exist anymore. But they were really, if you don't know, listen to Shaq. They were a great Liverpool band. However, the song that I wanted was something I had heard on a demo a long time ago and was never released. So it was literally like tracking down impossible to find stuff. Mm. There's a live Heartbreakers song from an ROIR cassette that, but I knew it had to be that 9 seconds of that. So, you know, so it was, you know, all this to say, it's about putting together a band, and most movies, including the movie about CBGBs, which is terrible, don't take the time to do that. And so for us, we had a long period of rehearsals beforehand, and we, you know, and I hope it shows when you watch the movie.
So just backing up a little bit, the set that you built for CB's, I don't remember the toilet being in the movie, but did you guys actually build out the bathroom as well?
Yeah, but we didn't, you know, not everything you shoot is in the movie. So
incredible.
So goodbye toilet. Yeah, no, it's true.
Yeah, I walked on that set and boy, oh boy, it was accurate by the centimeter. It was crazy accurate.
Yeah, and I don't know really at the end of the day why it needed to be that accurate.
I mean, it fooled Aaron and I. Like, it looked like the inside of CB's.
Yeah.
And also, you know, because there's this whole David Bowie thing through the whole movie, and indeed David Bowie is in the movie at the end of the movie. And because, I don't know, and he's such a, you know, my hero of heroes. And so I just felt like if everything was released that he wouldn't be embarrassed about saying yes to being in the movie. That was kind of my North Star.
So real quick side tangent, Todd, what was the name of your band?
The Pedantics.
Okay.
And I was not in them a long, long time. They went on for a while after I left because then I started getting acting work. And so that was it. But there, you can find all kinds of Pedantics, and there's a great archival website about them. They were a great band. And Sterling Campbell, the drummer, went on to become Bowie's drummer.
That's so crazy.
He was a member of Duran Duran. He was in Soul Asylum. He's, you know, he's a major. Now he does all the B-52s tours. He became like a major player, but he was 17 years old when he was in our band.
So for the theme of this show, obviously, and something I'm just completely fascinated by, why did ska and reggae factor so largely into this film? Especially, as you said before, it's all like kind of geared around this like obsession with David Bowie. So that's not like necessarily where I would have expected the music of this film to go.
No, I there's no particular connection between Bowie and ska. I don't know of any ska stuff that Bowie did. I mean, you know, Mick Jagger did that song with Peter Tosh, and I have that in the movie, the, you know, Walking Don't Look Back. But it was Bowie has kind of a mythic role in the movie. He's Galen's substitute dad because he grew up without a father. He's mentor, he's hero, he's whatever. So it's more than just his musical style or many, many styles that Bowie had that guides his character. And musically, Galen's character is, you can see in the movie, is into many different things. When he goes to CB, he's talking about, you know, a whole bunch of different bands. But what he wants to do with this band is make them a ska band. And you know from earlier on in the movie that he has a particular love for ska. And I have a particular love for ska. And I lived in England in 1979 and 1980 when the two-tone revival hit. And so it made a big impression on me. In fact, I am completely prepared to do a ska BTI right now.
Oh, man.
If anybody dares.
I had no idea you lived in England then. For those of you that don't know, BTI is this music game show that Todd is like the quiz master of.
I mean, a lot of people are. I'm one of them.
A lot of people are, but I particularly enjoy playing with Todd when he runs them. He'll play a song, and if you can guess...
It's name that tune, but... but with all kinds of other side rules that turn it into a blood sport.
All right, okay. Scott BTI.
Let's do it. I'm so down. I'm so in. We should organize that at some point for sure.
Maybe we'll do that for our Patreon portion.
Perfect.
So, but why, when you were writing the script, was there any particular reason why you sort of geared towards it being a ska band?
Well, ska bands have horn sections, which I love. And, you know, I wanted it to be a band. I didn't want it to be like The Jam. I didn't want it to be three guys, you know. I wanted it to be big and have a big sound and be theatrical and dance, you know, ska bands dance all over the place. And that, you know, there's something really to look at when you're watching a ska band beyond just, you know, like Oasis is reforming, which is great. And, you know, I love Oasis like everybody does. But they are boring as shit to watch live. Like, they do nothing, you know? And so I wanted it to be a band that I thought there would be something. And I love that music, you know, a lot. So, you know, I really want to do a movie about it. I want to, you know, do a movie called Sheep about a ska band that ends up unexpectedly touring in the Falklands when the war breaks out. Anyway.
Let's go. Investors, if you're listening.
Yeah.
Now, I don't think I've ever seen this represented in media before, and I feel like it kind of makes me feel a little seen. Like, I'm a ska fanatic, but I'm also a music fanatic. I'm not just a ska fanatic. And I feel like anytime you have a character who's like a fanatic of a genre, it's like that's their entire identity. If they're a metalhead, they're a metalhead, and they're a metalhead, right? But this character, he really likes ska a lot. He talks about ska, he loves Bowie. He loves Velvet Underground. He's making references to Arcade Fire and Clap Your Hands and Say Yeah. He goes on a whole thing about punk rock when they go to CBs. Like, I feel like that's more of the type of character I would relate to in a film than just like the ska guy who just endlessly talks about ska.
I think the easiest thing in the world would have been to put him in a pork pie hat and a sharkskin suit and winkle pickers and say he's, you know, a rude boy. And he goes to school and they all look at him funny because he's dressed like a, you know, what is, but then I don't think he would be as relatable as a kid. You know, the idea is that he's an outcast for not because he puts on a uniform that separates him from everybody. He's an outcast because he lives in his head and he's not the jock and he's not the metal. He's not all those things that you're talking about. He's who he is. You know, it's pretty autobiographical in terms, as if you can't tell, in terms of music, you know? And so, yeah, I agree. There was, one could have done the version about the ska fanatic who puts together a ska band and turns everybody onto ska, but that wasn't really this movie.
And that's not, I mean, how many people are actually like that?
Well, now, no. But definitely back then, you know, there were definitely, you know, you would walk down the street. I mean, I was living in London, but you would walk down the street and there were rude boys all over the place.
So so I assume you saw all of the main two-tone bands live back in the day?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you'd have to define main. I don't include Bad Manners. You know what I mean? But I certainly saw Specials in their heyday and beyond, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, saw Specials and Selector and you know, Madness. Well, they left Two Tone pretty quickly, and certainly the Beat, who I just saw the Beat at the Greek, like, you know, a month ago.
Any of those shows from the back in the day in the late 70s, early 80s that just sticks out in your head that you remember like just clearly?
There were different things, you know. One thing is, originally, I was just scared to death because it seemed early on, it seemed very NF, you know, and it was very, a lot of Sieg Heiling and a lot of, you know, skinheads and the skinny suspenders and the pushing the, and you know, I like a mosh pit as much as the next guy, and we have a great mosh pit scene in Band Slam, but it didn't seem, It felt more aggressive than I was used to. So that always made me a little nervous to be down front, you know. But when I would see, you know, musically the Beat, they were just unreal, you know. And to see those guys, that guitar and bass player, you know, Cox and Steele, and him with that insane dancing, like he was having, I don't know, spasms or whatever in his dancing, which was so watchable. And, you know, Dave Wakeling, well, I'm gay, so I had a crush on Dave Wakeling. You know, he was so cool and handsome and whatever. And Ranking Roger, who I also had a crush on, the Saxa was 35 years older than the rest of them. You know, it was in everything. It was such an egalitarian band. And then musically, they were so sophisticated. You know, Everett Quinton's drumming is insane. If you listen to Psychedelic Rockers or you listen to, I don't know, Too Nice to Talk To, you know, and even though those are not specifically ska songs, they're played with a ska sensibility. Selector was amazing because Pauline Black was a woman and you were like, there's a girl in this scene? And the Body Snatchers, who were the other all-girl group, were not, I mean, they were fun to watch, but they weren't real. They were barely musicians, you know. They were just there because they were the girls, it felt like. But not to be sexist, because they could have been really great female musicians on Two Tone. They just didn't seem to. And Rhoda from Body Snatchers became, you know, part of the Specials. And then Anne did the Boiler, obviously, by herself. And became. I don't mean to just ramble. You're the guys who asked me about ska.
No, we love it.
It's very difficult to get me to shut up. Ask Charlie something.
In Defense of Ska will return in a moment.
Yeah, Charlie, okay.
Yes.
When did you first get into ska?
Oh, man. So, you know, like most millennials, I was introduced to ska through, you know, pop culture, really. The Bosstones and Clueless, Goldfinger and Tony Hawk, Real Big Fish, because they were all over the radio. But when I was maybe like 12 or 13, my mom took me to our local music venue. It was this place called Sacred Grounds in Fallsington, Pennsylvania. And it was the basement of a Quaker meeting house. And for like $7, you would get to see like five bands. And they had what they always billed as an ambrosial snack buffet, which just had like, and it had every snack you could think of, and it was totally free. It was just like a space for kids to go and like listen to music and, you know, be safe on a Friday night. But so I think it was like the second or the third show I went, and my mom would always take me, and I would always stand in the back with her. And then all of a sudden I saw this guy who couldn't have been more than like 3 or 4 years older than me with a saxophone, like walk up to the soundboard and kind of like boot the sound guy, being like, I got this, I'll take this from here. And I just said, if this next band is a ska band, I'm going up front, which is like, I had never done anything like that before.
How old were you?
I was maybe 12 or 13 years old. And like, again, this venue is probably the size of my apartment, which isn't very large, but I still like fought my way up to the front. And yeah, it was just this high school ska band. And if anyone asks me like what my favorite genre of music is to this day, I will say it's the ska band that you had in high school or college. Cause it just like blew my fucking mind. There were this band called the Argyles. They're from Yardley, Pennsylvania. Sadly, they're not together anymore. But everything about it just like transformed me. The fact that these guys weren't that much older than me and they had a band and they wrote such like kick-ass songs. And the headliner for the night was Too Short Notice, which I was just like, holy fuck, this is like one of the best nights of my life. I just dived headfirst into the underground ska scene, particularly in on the East Coast. And I think it was the summer going into freshman year of high school. I think I did it on both websites. I did it on mp3.com and I did it on purevolume.com. I listened to every single ska band in America from A to Z, and I would like write down my favorite ones, and I would like make note of like who I really liked and who I wanted to keep listening to. And so I just had my list, and then I would listen to them like every day, and I would check up and see like if they were going to be touring or if anything, or if they were releasing any new music. And so, yeah, so I really fell in love with that like post third wave digital age ska music. And kind of a funny, fully serendipitous full circle story to that is one of my favorite bands from that experiment in that list was this band from Austin, Texas called Driver Friendly. And I just thought they were just so fucking talented. They started out as like a traditional ska band, and then they kind of branched out to more like progressive stuff and poppier stuff. But they were just like rock and roll with horns. And so when I booked Band Slam and found out that we were going to be shooting in Austin, Texas, my legitimate first reaction was, oh, this is cool. I'm finally going to be able to see a Driver Friendly show now. And so I mentioned previously, we rehearsed as a band for like 2 or 3 weeks. And on the first day of rehearsal, we were still waiting for the horn players to show up. And so like, you know, I'm chatting with literally Vanessa Hudgens, and, you know, I'm just like, oh, this is so cool. And then I look up and the doors open and the horn players from Driver Friendly walk in the door, and I literally dropped to my knees. I like freaked the fuck out. And mind you, these guys were like maybe freshmen in college, maybe sophomores. And it was like my Beatlemania. I freaked the fuck out. Todd was there. I was just like, oh my God. And I was like, you're Juan, you're Andy, you're the horn players and Driver Friendly. And they were just like, what? Who are you? And I was just like, you don't understand. Like, this is fucking insane. I was like, I'm from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. I've bought every one of your records. I have all your shirts. I have your buttons. Like, this is insane. And they were like, well, we're playing horns in this band. And I was like, shut the fuck up. No way. And so I lived out my dream of being in a ska band with the horn players of one of my favorite ska bands, Driver F. They're back to Driver Friendly now, but yeah, back then they had to drop the Friendly. And so it was just like, I'm getting goosebumps when I tell this story, because it's just so like meaningful and special to me. But so that night we were all hanging out at the hotel and we invited the Driver Friendly boys to come and hang out. And they were like, we checked our merch records. You're like the only person from Pennsylvania who ever bought anything. And I was like, I told you, I fucking love you guys. But it was just like, can you like just the most full circle, crazy serendipitous, just like, it was awesome.
Yeah. That's way up there.
Yeah. I mean, like crazy.
Just the fact that like your agent calls you and says, I got a script. It's about guys putting together a ska band.
Yeah. Like that alone. I was like, are you fucking kidding me? And I legitimately played the bass and they were like, they want you to read for the bass player. And I was just like, boy, oh boy, if I don't get this job, I'm going to be so upset. Yeah, it was just a literal dream come true. And so then because of that list, there are so many bands that unfortunately they're not on Spotify. They're not even on YouTube. And Pure Volume doesn't exist anymore. MySpace doesn't exist anymore. And so all I have are these like burnt compilation CDs that don't even like satiate the hunger that I have as bands that I used to listen to. So if not now or at some point, I was really hoping if I could read off a list of bands that I've missed, and if your listeners out there would be able to direct me to some sort of like digital archive where I can listen to these songs again, it would truly mean a lot to me.
Well, before we do that, I'm going to read a tweet. It probably relates. Mm-hmm. I'm going to read a tweet you sent in 2009. It said, Rochester, New York had the most kick-ass ska bands in the early 2000s. The Goonies, The Motives, The Light Bulbs, etc.
Yes. Yes. Okay. Those are just three of those bands, but like,
let's do the other ones.
Okay. But yeah, Light Bulbs were incredible. The Goonies were so fucking good. I think The Motives were like a spinoff of The Goonies, if I'm not mistaken. But anyway, okay. Mm. So in alphabetical order, we have, Bob and the Saggots, who then went on to become the Menzingers.
Yep. Tom May has been on the show.
Ah, yes. Amazing. Tom's great. Tom taught me how to open a beer bottle by smashing it against like the edge of whatever surface that you have, which I was like, that's the most like, that's like a Menzinger's lyric. Like, so these guys are still around, but Captain Squeegee and the Soap Suds, they're based out of Arizona. The Dissenters, they're more of like a tri-state Jersey band. They played at Sacred Grounds. I saw them perform with Too Short Notice many years ago. So the Ska Skank Redemption, I know they're from out here, but they then became the Incredible Machine, which was like, I went back and I listened to their album and it's like, it was Pup before there was Pup. It was Jeff Rosenstock. I mean, he had been around, but it just has all, I felt like the Incredible Machine was like so ahead of their time. And I never got to see them perform, which was a huge bummer. But yeah, then we got the Light Bulbs, the Goonies, the Motives. I voted for Kodos, classic. They're great. Driver Friendly. Here's one of my favorite ska band names is Your Mom and the Kerplunks. If anyone out there If anyone out there has Your Mom and the Kerplunks songs, please, please send them my way. There was this band from the UK that I loved called 9 Pound Note. I still have their CD, thankfully. And their guitar, I randomly reached out to their guitar player like 4 or 5 months ago because I had put on the CD again and I was just like, fuck, it's so good. It has everything that I love about the sound of the band that you start with your friends in high school, where it's just like so raw, kind of sloppy, but like, you're trying to show off your musical abilities. And like, there's just something so endearing and awesome about that. And I just love a horn section. Like Todd said, I'm a sucker for a horn section. Some other bands that I loved, SGR, they were awesome. The Best of the Worst. I think they're still doing their thing.
They're still going.
And then they got Thirsty Guys as their side project. A Billion Ernies. If anyone used to rock it, loved the Billion Ernies. Controversial take. I think a Billion Ernies did like a one-off Dashboard Confessional ska cover band that they called Dashboard Ska. And they released like four songs on their pure volume page. And they were incredible covers of Dashboard Confessional songs. And then, yeah, those were like the main MySpace ones that I can't really find much of. But then, like, I remember during that era, I went on eBay and Moonska Records was having this like huge sale where I got, I want to say like 50 CDs for like not a lot of money. And it was through that I learned about bands like Rude Bones. And Rude Bones is like legends and they're still doing their thing. And so then obviously when I was in high school, I started a band with a bunch of friends, and classic scenario where we were a ska band for one day. We had like six of us in my music teacher's rehearsal room and like we all played together, and then, you know, the horn players were not really interested in being in a ska band, so they kind of disbanded. So my band, we were called Cool Kids Going to the Beach. And we were that punk band that always played with ska bands because we had ska undertones, even though we didn't have a horn section. And so like, yeah, I would say during the second or the third year of our band, I just wanted us to sound like RX Bandits so badly. Like, I just wanted us to have that cool, progressive, but ska influence. We did okay. We were no RX Bandits by any means. But my band ended up playing with a lot of people that I loved and respected and discovered because of the mp3.com and the pure volume digging through the crates. So we played with We Are the Union back in like 2007, which was even then for me was so fucking huge and still one of like the coolest shows. We played with Rick Johnson one time at the 449 room in Trenton, and like it's burned in my memory as like one of the most embarrassing moments of my life, because Rick Johnson was like doing his thing and I was like clapping along, and like I was trying to start a clap with other people, and like and Rick like stops the song, like completely kills the song, and he's like, hold on, he's like, if you're gonna clap along, make sure you're clapping on the right notes. And I was like, oh no, fuck. I've told people that story before and they're like, that's the most Rick Johnson story I can think of. Yeah, man. And then there were some other ones like Last Martyrs of a Lost Cause and Legitimate Business were some of the bands that we played with back in the day.
If Rick Johnson is listening, do you want to tell him how many hours of therapy that moment cost you?
Dude, you owe me is what I'll say. I have never not thought of that moment.
I'm trying to think of how you would clap along to a ska song. Like, you can't clap on the two and the four, right? And dun, 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 it would be...
I think I was clapping on the two and the four. I'm so sorry, Todd. I'm so sorry. But it wasn't like, it wasn't a ska part of a song. It was definitely like a breakdown. It was a breakdown bridge. And yeah, I think I was clapping on the two and the four, and he specifically was like, let's clap on the one and three.
Why do you recall my phone calls? You know, it's, it comes a different thing. It's not Scott anymore.
If he is listening, I just want to say, Rick Johnson, I'm sorry, and thank you for for helping me.
So the Goonies, I have the split with Kicked in the Head, and I have the full length.
Oh, that's awesome. Do you have them digitized?
I can digitize them, yeah.
Oh, dude, thank you.
I might have a shirt squirreled away somewhere.
Oh my God. I want to see all of this.
I got to play two shows with the Goonies, and the first time they were just like a really intense ska core band. Mm-hmm. And then the second time they sounded like the Locust.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Like they just got real weird.
Oh yeah. Yeah, I was man, I haven't heard any of their music in so long. But what's crazy is that like there are certain songs, like there's a song by the Motives that like constantly plays on my head about them like wanting to date Britney Spears and Christina Aguilera. And then the last line of the song is like, we're one step closer to Mandy Moore. Classic.
So I read an article from like 2011. You were being interviewed by the Hollywood Reporter. It was related to Hung promotion.
Mm-hmm.
And the interviewer commented on the fact that you were wearing a Save Ferris shirt.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I loved that shirt. I think I wore it out so much that it had to become like a t-shirt quilt of mine. But yeah, I love that band too.
So Todd, I want to ask about the premise of Band Slam, this battle of bands that was so important to this this area. Was that inspired by any personal experience? Was there like a battle of the bands where you grew up like this?
No, you know, I was a kid actor. I was acting professionally since I was 9 years old. And so I didn't have like a normal school experience. I went to professional children's school. It was that kind of thing. I did not even get into that kind of music until my late, really, really, honestly, until I was a freshman in college, I would say, was when, I don't know, the Food for Thought and King came out, like the first UB40 single came out, which, you know, when they were still an indie, you know, band on Graduate, or the first Dexys, or the first whatever, you know, there was before then, I was not really like, I mean, I knew rock music, but it wasn't like my thing. And then when I got to college, it became my thing.
I'm just curious, like where the inspiration for you came to make a movie about a battle of bands.
Well, it didn't come from me. I wasn't the first writer on the movie.
Oh, you weren't? Okay.
No. The movie originally, I mean, you wouldn't recognize what it turned into in any way, shape, or form. But originally, if you can believe this, it was a spin on Charlotte's Web, you know, the kids' book Charlotte's Web. Which is why Charlotte's character is named Charlotte and Will is named Will for Wilbur. And Charlotte had a terminal disease and it was a different thing. It was completely different. And when it came to me, I said, well, if I was going to come aboard, this is what I would want to do with it. And probably the only thing that stayed was the fact that I can't even swear that there was a battle of the bands. He was not a manager type, you know, Will. he wasn't a Brian Epstein originally in their version. You know, it was so long ago, I don't even really remember. But there's very little, but it must have been somehow in that, because I can't imagine that I thought of Battle of the Bands. It's not really like a thing of mine.
We'll be right back after this.
Okay, so this is David Bowie. We've already talked about David Bowie, and this is his final film that he acted in before he passed away. So David Bowie is big for you. What was your entry point to Bowie, since you kind of saying earlier that you weren't, you know, you were really kind of off the radar with rock music until college?
Yeah, I mean, just because I wasn't into Bowie in the mid-70s or early 70s didn't mean I wasn't like aware of him. But I would say the first Bowie album that changed my life was Scary Monsters. And like every track on it was so unbelievable. And the Robert Fripp stuff all over it. And that album is such a masterpiece to me. And it was at a time when he was starting to crossover. Obviously, he was hugely famous already, and Fame was the number one song when I was a kid and whatever. But when I started going to clubs, when I started going to the Ritz, or, you know, clubs that I started going to when I was a freshman in college, Ashes to Ashes was hitting, and then Fashion was hitting. And that's what really made me seek out all the rest of Bowie, was the Scary Monsters record.
That's interesting, because it's similar to me, because I grew up, I was born in 1975, so Bowie to me was 80s Bowie. Mm-hmm. And you know, and like in retrospect, I see that there's some good stuff there, but you know, he was just like a pop star on MTV. I didn't think of him as like an artsy guy, but I heard people talk about him that way, and I had a friend get really into him, and until I heard Scary Monsters, it just didn't click with me, like what was so great about 70s Bowie.
Right. And that's barely 70s Bowie. That's the bridge into 80s Bowie.
Yeah, yeah. But once I heard that record and I loved it, I was like, okay, I got to hear every single one of his records.
Oh, yeah. And then, yeah, of course, you know, every one of those records from Ziggy on is, you know, he was, nobody can touch him in my view. The idea that I got to know him and become friendly with him and make a movie with him and, you know, use his songs. And, you know, he didn't charge us, like, we had no budget. He didn't charge us virtually anything for any of his songs. He came in to do ADR, you know, which is the looping after you shoot, the additional dialogue recording. And he had to do some ADR because he had, you hear what he says in voiceover in our movie, because he's supposedly, you know, typing a message to our lead character. And so when our actors, who were all musicians, found out that he was going to come in for ADR, what a surprise. They all showed up on the day that David Bowie came in for ADR.
He's talking about me and Galen, by the way.
And he was so great and so gracious. And I remember when they asked for his autograph, he said, I'll do it under one condition, that you give me yours, because yours is going to become more valuable than mine.
That was honestly one of the that was the second craziest thing that had ever happened to me, because the first craziest thing that had ever happened to me also involved David Bowie. They were shooting his scene in New York. And like we said, we had filmed most of the movie in Austin, and they did a couple of exterior shots in New York, as well as just David Bowie's like one scene. And so I was wrapped from the movie. My work was done, but I found out that they were going to be in New York, and I found out that David Bowie is going to be shooting his stuff. So I was just like, I'll just come say hi. I'll come visit. I missed you guys, you know? And so I'm standing there with Galen, and Todd comes up to us and he goes, would you like to meet David Bowie? And we both were just like, yeah, dude. And so he takes us to the back room of this coffee shop, and there's David Bowie with Iman and like the coolest entourage you could ever fucking imagine. And he could not have been nicer, sweeter, genuinely tried to have a conversation with Galen and I, but we both were just gobsmacked. We were just like, ah. And, you know, bless him, he gave up because we weren't giving him anything. We were just like, yeah, this, it's so cool. And so finally he just looks at me and goes, look at you, Charlie. You've got such a great face. And he pinched my cheek. He pinched my right cheek. I'll never forget. He pinched my right cheek. And then I look over at Galen, and Galen just has this mixture of just like envy and astonishment on his face. And he's just like, whoa. And then Bowie goes, ah, you're cute too. And smacks Galen across
the face.
Slapped him right across the face. It was incredible.
That was crazy. I remember that when he slapped Galen.
He slapped Galen. And so then fast forward. Yeah, I had done my ADR. I was done for the day, but I found out Bowie was going to be there. So me and Galen were like, let's just go get some lunch and just like come back. And like, you know, we want to see Todd some more. And so, yeah, he asked us for our autograph. And I was just like, and Galen signed his, I think it was like his timesheet is what he signed. And Galen wrote like, this is the coolest thing ever, like Galen. And so in my mind, I was like, okay, I totally biffed it the first time I met him. I didn't say anything. Like, this is my probably last chance to just like say something to this legend. So I got the pen and I'm writing and I'm just like, seriously, like, this is the coolest thing that has ever happened to me. You have no idea how much this means. And like, I was just kind of going, and then Bowie just cuts me off and goes, well, don't make a meal out of it. And I was just like, you're right. And I signed it and I gave it back to him.
When we were shooting, he showed up. He was going to do his own hair, makeup, costume. He didn't want any of that stuff from us. Okay, great. Whatever you want. You're playing you, so you should look the way you look. So he showed up and he was wearing this really cool but long winter coat. And we're about to shoot and he's sitting where he's supposed to sit. And I said, well, we have to lose the coat. And he said, what? I said, well, the scene takes place in June and, you know, you wouldn't be wearing a heavy winter coat. And he said to me, I would. And I said, you would? And he said, because it's not a coat. It's an attitude.
Oh. I say that for everything. It's not aioli, it's an attitude.
Spoiler alert. If you haven't seen the film, you know, this is a spoiler.
Yeah.
You had time.
It's been out for 15 years.
So David Bowie, the band of the film called I Can't Go On, I'll Go On. They play a ska song at the talent show. They don't win, but the video starts to go viral and David Bowie sees it and says, I got to sign this band. So what I appreciate is that you've created a narrative where David Bowie just randomly sees a ska band on his computer and is like, I need to sign this ska band right now.
Well, the thing is, he had his finger on the pulse. He used to go to clubs. He really was on top of what was going on. I went to a thing called Fashion Rocks once upon a time, and it was the first time Arcade Fire were ever given national exposure. And Bowie was like the headliner, and it turned out that Bowie was the one that got Arcade Fire onto that CBS primetime thing. You know, he was really up. He would have conversations with me about, you know, bands that I had never heard of that he went to see in a club.
Do you want to tell us how you ended up getting Bowie in this film? I'm curious about that.
As Charlie had mentioned before, there's a woman named Linda Cohen, a gazillion years ago, was my assistant for many years, or several years. And we stayed and are still extremely close friends. And all she ever wanted to be was a music supervisor. And so when she ultimately left working for me, she moved to New York. She married her husband, who became our musical director, Adam Lazis, who produced the first Clap Your Hands, Say Yeah record, for example, and a bunch of other stuff. He's great, great producer. So she became a music supervisor and a very successful one. And so when we were putting Bandslam together, of course, as on all my movies, I hire Linda to be the music supervisor. And she said, well, I have a real relationship with David Bowie's lawyer and team and people. So I don't know that he's ever going to want to be involved, but I could get the script to him. Or if you wrote a letter or an email, whatever, I could, I have channels where I think we could get it at least to him to see if he would be interested. And so that was it. I wrote him, you know, kind of the letter of my lifetime, and we sent him the script. And obviously it is, it couldn't be more of a love letter to him. It deifies him. And he came back right away and said, yeah, I'll do it. That was it.
It's always interesting to me. Like, so there's, you can become a celebrity, you know, you can become a person that people recognize or a fan of, but then there's like the next level where it's like you become sort of this like icon. And so you kind of like go beyond like being a person almost, right? Like that happened to Bowie, that happened to Bob Marley, that happened to Jerry Garcia. And some people like, I don't think handle it well. Like I remember watching a thing on Grateful Dead, and like it was really difficult for Jerry Garcia once he became like the deity of Jerry Garcia. Like I think that happened in like the 80s or early 90s. Like it was not a comfortable situation for him to be in.
Luckily he had drugs to escape to.
But you know, for but it sounds like Bowie like kind of handled it okay. Like he kind of understood that he was not viewed as a person but as this sort of icon. Yeah,
at that point. But also remember, in terms of, you know, whatever is the next level up from cult status, right? But where people are insanely devoted to you. That's where he was for many years, certainly, you know, in England. But I think and he did not handle it so well. He became a drug addict and he lost a gazillion pounds and he moved to Berlin and he almost died. And, you know, so he kind of had gone through that, I think, earlier. And unexpectedly, because of almost like the fluke of becoming a pop star with Let's Dance, he elevated into this whole other headline stadiums realm.
Yeah.
Because he couldn't have played a stadium before that, I don't think.
No, you're right. Late 70s Bowie, he was in pretty tough shape in terms of drugs. He was like flirting with fascism as like an expression of art, which he kind of, you know, I think once he got some pushback on that, he walked away from that. But yeah, like, I remember watching some videos of him in the 80s when he became the pop star you're talking about. And his whole approach to being an arena pop star was that the arena pop star was a character and he approached it like that. And I thought that was so brilliant. And then he even like kind of like baked it into like how he presented it in interviews.
Because that's what he always did, whether he was Thin White Duke or he was, you know, Ziggy or whatever. He was always Aladdin Sane. He was always a persona that he put on. And so then he put on, I always felt like he just watched a lot of Brian Ferry and said, oh, I can do that. And that's what he did.
On that topic, and Todd, forgive me if I'm putting words in your mouth, but one of the coolest stories that you had told me about Bowie when we were shooting was when we were in New York, we were shooting at a record store that was literally called Rebel Rebel.
Right.
And Todd went to Bowie and was like, oh, you got to go visit this record store. You got to meet the owner. Like, he loves you. Like, he would have a heart attack if he met you. And Bowie just went, that's what I'm afraid of. which I was just like, wow, what a profound thing to say. And just like, what a crazy thought to have that, like, you meeting someone could potentially cause a cardiac arrest for them. Like,
it was crazy that, you know, that was my local import record store. You know, it was walking distance from my apartment, and it's where I went for, you know, that's where I got all my imports. And the guy that owned it and ran it, his name is David. He was a really great guy. I didn't have a relationship beyond the record store with him, but I was in that record store a lot, you know? And so when we were shooting one block away from his store called Rebel Rebel, and he's the biggest Bowie fan ever, and Bowie's not going to go over to Rebel Rebel, I said to David, because we shot in his store, I said, come over. We're at this coffee shop on Christopher Street. It's like half a block away. What's he going to do? Come in. I'll introduce you. And David was also said, no, I can't. I don't. Like, you know, it's one of those things where, like, I don't know, somewhere in time where he sees the money from the wrong era and the whole thing dissolves. And the, you know, like he was afraid his entire world would collapse if it didn't go perfectly.
Oh, that's so funny. I didn't know the other side of that story. I didn't realize that he didn't want to meet him either.
He didn't.
That's perfect. Oh, I love that. That's great.
Okay, so I want to talk about the music in this film of Band Slam, particularly the ska reggae stuff. So pretty early in the film, we have the Peter Tosh Mick Jagger song, You Gotta Walk, Don't Look Back.
Mm-hmm.
That's an interesting, can you explain that song a little bit and why you chose that for the film? Because this isn't a scene where Will is with his mom, they're driving and listening to this song, and he's kind of explaining what this song is.
Right. I wanted to have a scene early on where you understood what Will's passion was and that he wasn't full of shit, that he really knew what he was talking about, that he was a student of the form, that he loved it so much, and he just wanted his world to be that. And his mom, bless her, she loves her son, but she didn't know anything about that stuff. And so he's got to talk to her like she's, you know, 12 and explain what it is. And it serves the dual purpose of explaining to the audience what ska is, you know, that it's sped up reggae, but it has a pop influence, but it blah, 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 blah. And so the way that the song that I chose was because it's a cover version, and it's a cover version that was done by Peter Tosh, who obviously is a huge reggae star, and Mick Jagger. Like, they did that song together on Saturday Night Live. You know, it was a top 10 Billboard 100 hit. It was a big hit song. And I thought I could use the Israelites, which was also a pop hit that was a ska song, but 15 years or 10 years before Walk and Don't Look Back. So I thought, this is the closest I'm going to get to a song that people might have been like, oh yeah, I know what that song is. Oh, that's ska? Oh, okay. Oh yeah, Will loves, okay. You know, just so that, since I'm about to have an hour and a half of obsessive ska exploration, I thought I should at least explain what ska is.
Yeah. And the mother, by the way, is Lisa Kudrow from Friends.
A goddess.
Yeah.
Who we have always, trolling the ska subreddits, I've seen people say that the Jeff Rosenstock band Kudrow was a answer to Band Slam's Lisa Kudrow.
Hmm.
I don't have an answer for that, but
Aaron can get to the bottom of that.
Yeah.
I'll get to the bottom of that.
Perfect.
Okay, so you have the Agrolites. Their song Free Time, I think, comes up a couple of times in the film, right?
Yeah.
Twizzler?
Food of the Gods.
Ska.
I like it. It's like reggae, but they made it their own.
Exactly.
You know, they're a great band, and you know, I love their records, and that was just that moment, you know, needed. You know, Will is the most important point when it comes up is when Will is on top of the world. You know, everything is going great, and he is at school, and he's listening to it in his earbuds, but he's sort of strutting down the hallway of the school. And it's just a really great strutting ska song.
Mm-hmm. It's definitely got like a celebratory quality to it for sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
Out of curiosity, aside from Charlie here, in the how many people in the cast did you feel like understood this music and knew what you were talking about in this film when you're talking about ska and stuff?
Well, it's not obviously, you know, Charlie did and Driver F did, but it's not so much, and why would they? It's not so much that they came to the project with a knowledge of ska. It's that they soaked it up like sponges. They really wanted to become a band, you know, and the band is a ska band. And so they, as we have learned in the last 45 minutes, I like to pontificate on the subject. And so they were great about sitting there and getting the history lessons and, you know, all the things that Galen's character probably in scenes that we don't see would be saying to these musicians about what ska is. It was important for them to know because they had to feel it. They had a, you know, by the time they got to the, you know, the final song, it had to feel like they could win, that they could genuinely and credibly win that Battle of the Bands contest. And if they had no real sense of ska kind of seeping into their bones, I don't know that that would have been believable.
Yeah, I want to talk about that closing song because this is an interesting choice, and the song has a very interesting history, which I want to kind of discuss the history first, and then you can kind of just tell me why you chose this song. So Everything I Own.
Well, it's a reggae tune.
Well, actually, it originally was written by the folk rock band Bread.
Really? I thought Bread covered it. They wrote it?
It's my understanding that they wrote it and then Ken Booth covered it.
Oh, okay. I'm sure. Well, you're the scholar. I'm sure you're okay, right.
Now you're making me doubt. I'm going to have to look
it up. No. I believe you. The version that I know, I mean, yes, I heard the Bread because it was like on AM radio when I was 7 or whatever. But the version I knew was the reggae version. And then Boy George covered it and had a big hit with it, bringing it back to the reggae version. Like it wasn't kind of a sappy AM radio ballad. He did it as a reggae tune. And so my knowledge of that song was more solidly the reggae version of it. And so I wanted to find a song that Sam's character could have been, we see on a video in the movie, she's playing acoustic guitar and she's singing this ballad, and it's how Galen's character realizes what a good singer she is. And so it had to be a song that she could have sung in that context originally, just her sitting with the acoustic guitar doing a ballad that then could credibly become a ska song. And so because this really was credibly a reggae song, that also was an acoustic ballad, it felt like a good choice to me.
Yeah. So you do. So, and I think you even say when she's singing it as an acoustic song that it was that Bread did it. So you kind of referenced the Bread version. Yeah. So I did double check. Bread did write the song. Ken Booth, but his version was a number one hit in the UK. And also Boy George's version was a number one hit as well in the UK. I don't believe any of these versions of the songs were hits in the US, interestingly. So this is a very known song in the UK, but not so much in the US. And this is a film that takes place in New Jersey.
Yeah, but the music is all filtered through a character who's obsessed with David Bowie and with Two Tone and with, you know, so for him, he probably never heard the Bread version, you know?
Oh, and apparently NSYNC covered this song in the 90s too. So. They did not do a reggae version, unfortunately.
They should have.
Missed opportunity.
But I think the fact that everything you said about the song is what made it an interesting choice for this film. Like, it wasn't an obvious song at all.
You know, I hope that none of the songs are really obvious. You know, there's... And of all the songs, it's probably the most obvious because at least there was a hit of it, you know. But the tunes are, well, no, I Want You to Want Me obviously was a giant, giant hit. But they don't do that as a ska song. When I'm doing a movie, you know, I've made 3 movies, they've all been musicals, and they all are filtered through, I write everything that I direct. And all my movies are my personal taste. That's just what it is. I don't know really how to do a movie as kind of a gun for hire. And my passions have to inform the work that I do. I don't really know how to do it in another way. And so whether it's there being like a soundtrack that's got Velvet on, you know, the I'm falling in love with the girl song, and it is a Velvet Underground song in this. So they really had no hits. You know what I mean? So it all just has to be ring true to me. And then I hope it will ring true to other people, because to me, you know, the personal becomes the universal. And if you try for the universal, you inevitably have to be going for a lower common denominator, I think. So anyway, that's just my view of it. But I also have only made 3 movies. You know, I don't get hired to make a lot of stuff. So there you go.
Well, Todd, you had always said that if anything comes from this movie, is that it gets one kid to listen to the Velvet Underground for the first time, then that's all that we've done our job. So
there you go. Well, you know, there's that famous quote about that first Sex Pistols concert that only like 40 people were in the audience, but all 40 of them started a band. You know, so that's what we're hoping.
Hell yeah.
We all know that famous quote about all the kids that discovered Velvet Underground through a ska movie.
Exactly.
The one kid who watched the ska movie.
And then, of course, I had to pick the Nico album. I couldn't have picked, if I was a real purist, I wouldn't have picked that album.
Now, this film was reviewed pretty favorably by critics, but it was not successful commercially.
It was successful enough.
Was it enough? I mean, okay.
Yeah, it was cheap to make. And it was, you know, it's gone on to have whatever life it's gone on to have. And so, yeah, I would have loved for it to make a good, you know, break the bank. But it was, no one ever asked me to turn it into that movie. And God knows there are 2 million high school movies. And so, I don't know, it was never, I kept waiting to get tapped on the shoulder and say, what are you doing? What are you know, this is, you have to throw them a bone. You can't make it be that it's just your taste. And then maybe other people will like it. You know, it was when they wanted to release a single from the soundtrack before the movie was released, and they thought, oh, well, maybe we'll release a single, and nobody, they tacked on this song by a band called Plain White Tees. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know that record. I didn't know that band. They said, oh, no, they have a... Okay, you know, I had no say in it, but it's only on the soundtrack. It's not on the soundtrack of the movie. You don't hear it in the movie, but it's on the record. But that's like as close as it ever came to us trying, you know, or them trying, you know, to impose something on me. So, okay. That, and they didn't want the movie to end the way it did. They wanted the movie to end with Will on the floor after he talks to Bowie. You know, there's the homage to the Lodger cover.
Yeah.
From the way Will is splayed out on the ground. And they wanted that to be the end of the movie. And I said, but it can't be. The answer to his problems is not that David Bowie wants to sign his band. The answer to his life has to be that he's going to be okay. And his relationships with people are going to be okay. And what about him and the girl? We need that last scene from the high school graduation and them taking off in the car, and everybody's okay in their band and their community, and it's all going to be okay together. And they said, no, we don't. We need the movie not to be an hour and 55 minutes is what we need. So, but they, at the end of the day, they gave in.
Now I'm curious how you feel like the marketing did, because I didn't catch this movie initially because I wasn't a teen when this movie came out, so it didn't cross my mind. I wasn't aware of it. And I was watching, before I watched the movie, I watched the trailer. And I was really expecting a different movie based off the trailer. Like, I feel like the trailer was saying, this is kind of your run of the mill teen comedy. Like, it didn't give me the impression that it was going to have all the cool stuff that ended up being in the movie.
Well, you know, the thing is, Vanessa Hudgens was one of the stars.
Yeah.
And Alan Shaka, who also had been like a Disney or Nickelodeon star when she had been younger. Now Ali and AJ have obviously gone on to, like, they headline The Greek now. But when you have those, and Galen, no one knew who Galen was. And so that's who they had. And so High School Musical was a pop culture phenomenon globally. I'm sure it's the only reason we were green lit was because Vanessa Hudgens signed on. And so I'm sure they thought they would have been fools not to lean into that. It's just that, you know, kids can smell it. And when High School Musical was giant, those kids were 12 years old. And now those kids are 16 years old. And no 16-year-old wants to listen to what they listened to when they were 12. It's not what you're into anymore. And so they just kind of, I think with all the best intentions, they kind of missed the mark.
Yeah.
I was definitely still listening to Weird Al's Running with Scissors when I was 16. just say, but I understand what you mean, Todd. I understand what you mean.
It is a well-written film. And I didn't expect it to be so character-driven. I think that's the thing. It's so character-driven. The characters are very believable, eccentric, but believable. Like, that's the part I feel like I was a little bit pleasantly blindsided by.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. Thank you. You know, I wrote, it hasn't been made yet, but I wrote the Brian Epstein biopic.
Mm.
And I wrote that. I wrote it for Jude Law, who's too old to do it now, but he's who hired me to write it. And I happened to write that right before I took the job of writing Bandslam. And so it was so in my head, the thing of the guy who doesn't have the talent but wants to have it. And so as soon as the lead character is not one of the musicians, I think it takes the stink off of it. It takes the onus off of, you know, what's it going to be? Oh, adulation and then a downfall. Oh, he loses himself because everybody now is kissing his ass. Oh, the whatever, all the tropes that every one of those movies do, I'm sure, because in many cases that's really what happens, but they become tropes anyway. I didn't really have to worry about that. I could really make it character driven because he was not, it was a way into that kind of a story that doesn't get told as often. You know, what if you're the guy that loves it so much, but you can't actually do it?
Would you call this a cult film? There is a certain amount of fandom that has followed this film, right?
I hope. You never know. I mean, I'm not on social media. I'm not plugged into any of that stuff. So I only know when someone tells me something and I think, oh, that's great. Or someone sends me a link. There's a fantastic video of these Japanese kids. I don't know if you saw it. Who recreate amphetamine, you know, the scene from the movie, the Steve Wynn song. Mm-hmm. And just these Japanese kids are doing it as an homage to the movie, to the scene in the movie. And that was like, you know, fantastic. But I hope that that's true. For me, because of the movies that I've made and the kinds of movies that I've made, for good or ill, all of them, I'm sure, have enormously improved. Maybe would have been if made by other people, but these are my movies. And so I have to do it. And then, you know, it's done. It's out there in the world. And I hope. I made a movie called Camp that I wrote and directed. And that, like, I really realized how that's still alive in the world when, like this, I was called to see if I would do a 20th anniversary thing to raise a charity thing. And suddenly there's all these thousands of people watching this podcast and we're raising all this money. And I kind of knew that, like, my friends liked that movie, but I really didn't know that it had gone out into the world to that extent. When I was contacted about this, I thought, I don't know these guys, right? Like, they're not my family or anything. They actually know the movie? That's great.
Yeah, the kids still talk about it, Todd. Don't worry. There's hashtags on TikTok and there's people making there's people making videos about it, and no, we're still kicking.
I would have no idea. I'm too old.
Thank you for listening to In Defense of Ska. To support the show, sign up for our Patreon. Intro and outro music by Slow Gherkin from the EP Lives. Additional music by Dan P. and the Bricks. Please rate and review the podcast and tell a friend. Follow at In Defense of Ska on social media. The book In Defense of Ska by Aaron Carnes is available from Clash Books. Order it online. Chris Reeves of SPI is our editor. This is your co-host, Adam Davis of Omnigon, leaving you by saying ska now more than ever.
All right, you've heard the episode. Have you watched the movie yet? Go watch the movie. Go watch Bandslam. When you're done watching Bandslam, sign up for the In Defense of Ska Patreon to hear what we had to say behind the curtain.
So much. Oh my God, we had so much to say.
You sound drunk. Are you drunk? It's not even noon yet.
That's the thing about behind the curtain. We record the episode. We're in our suit and ties. We hit stop. We loosen that tie a bit. We get a few cocktails. And then We say what we really think. And wow, do we ever just let loose?
You're really just drawing a mental picture right now. I love it.
So yeah, $5 or more.
Or more.
All you got to do is reach into that wallet, grab that crisp $5 bill or more, maybe a $10 bill, maybe a $20 bill.
Yeah.
Maybe a $50 bill.
Oh.
And then just throw that in an envelope, put In Defense of Ska on it, lick the envelope, make sure you do that and put a stamp on there and give it to the guy at the post office.
I don't think that's how that works, but you can do it on the internet.
Or just do it on the internet. I don't know. However you feel like doing it.